The Guardian. The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again. This week's podcast is a matter of life and death. That's to say, we'll be talking about the creation of life and the desperate lengths we all go to avoid its inevitable end. Although that word inevitable might be a matter of contention between the three panellists in our studio discussion. They are two scientists and a philosopher, and they've all just published books touching on these eternal issues. Then, writer Paul Bailey will tell us about his new novel about someone pretty much like him, but bedbound and flickering through reality and imagination.
How many funerals can a man have? And just how many times can he die? These were the questions nagging Harry Chapman as he lay in an open coffin waiting for the service to begin.
We'll also be taking a break to discuss whether, in this age of social media, people like us, the critics and the journalists, are needed anymore. We've had a nice talkative thread going on our site at guardian.co.uk/books, including our very own first recorded questions from you, the listeners.
I can't dream of a world without book critics. My worst nightmare, perhaps, is opening the newspaper on a Sunday morning and finding the book's page blank.
That was Prashanza T, all the way from Delhi. With me here in the studio to discuss such issues are Observer writer Robert McCrum, Katie Evans-Bush, the author of the literary blog Baroque in Hackney, and Richard Lee from our own books website. But now, how are you feeling? Oppressed by dread of your own mortality? Curious as to whether there is a life hereafter, and if so, how you will fare in it? These are the questions John Gray has been puzzling over in his book, The Immortalization Commission, Science and the Strange Quest to Cheat Death. Our own science correspondent, Alok Jha, goes straight to the point with the title question of his new book, How to Live Forever and 34 Other Really Interesting Uses of Science. And another science writer, Philip Ball, joins us with his look at our age-old obsession with creating life. His book is called Unnatural, The Heretical Idea of Making People. I asked each of them to give us an outline of their theses, beginning with Alok Jha.
The idea of this is to say that this is an idea that people have had for lots and lots of centuries. How close are we scientifically to doing something like it? And I won't give you the answer.
But it's a bit of a tease, your title, in fact, isn't it? Because it's one of 35
scientific
propositions. That's right.
The idea being that there's 35 chapters in there. Each one is a scientific principle framed around a question that you may or may not be curious about. So how to go back in time, how to grow faster than your twin, that kind of thing.
So, Philip, we haven't actually yet reviewed your book. It's called Unnatural, The Heretical Idea of Making People. You've written a biography of water, haven't you? You've written very serious scientific books. How serious is this and what is the story you're telling?
Well, this is really a social history, I guess, and it's a social history of that idea, which goes back a very long way. In fact, it goes back into myth and legend. And I'm essentially looking at, first of all, at how those myths and legends, and I include within them modern myths such as Frankenstein and Brave New World, how they are still conditioning, often unconsciously, the way we think about technologies that intervene in reproduction, so assisted conception and also cloning and even stem cells. The ideas that we acquire from those myths are very deep-rooted, and they pop up not only most obviously in sort of lazy journalistic references to Frankenstein whenever some new development in reproductive technology comes along, but also in the way that I think politicians and even scientists themselves make assumptions about what it means, what it entails to, in some sense, create people artificially, and in particular, what those people will be like. So instead of cheating death, it's creating life. There are probably some overlaps. I think there are certainly overlaps in each of those cases in the sense that both are deep-rooted mythological ideas.
Now I'm going to move to John Gray, whose book is The Immortalization Commission, Science and the Strange Quest to Cheat Death. Can you explain to me what you're doing in your book?
Well, the book partly consists of two stories, one about some investigators in Edwardian England, psychical researchers, and another about some of the events and ideas surrounding Lenin's entombment in early Soviet Russia. And in quite different ways, each of these two stories illustrates something, in fact, that Philip has just said, which is that science is surrounded by myth. I would go slightly further and say that science has been a vehicle for myth. And in the late 19th, early 20th century, science, with the ebbing of religion, became a vehicle for some of the hopes and some of the ambitions that religion had served. And chiefly, I suppose, in the cases I'm considering, the idea that humans could somehow circumvent or avoid death, or did not in fact die at all. Because, of course, my view about the impact of Darwinism in the 19th century, late 19th century, is that for many people in England and also in other countries at the time, including large sections of the most influential thinkers, politicians, cultural figures, psychologists, the impact of Darwinism was not so much in proposing a non-religious theory of creation. It was in maintaining that humans are animals and will suffer the fate of other animals when they die. That's to say, as individuals, they will perish and vanish and disappear. And eventually, as a species, they'll also disappear. And that vision was extraordinarily hard to assimilate for people because it seemed to be a desolate view offering no hope. And in addition, with the ebbing of religion in England, for example, in the late 19th, early 20th century, people needed something to help them to cope with the crises of bereavement.
You've got some very sad stories here, haven't you? Even Darwin was partly terribly affected by the death of his daughter, wasn't
yes.
he?
Yes, I think that was more important than his theory itself in estranging him and alienating him from conventional religion. But the key thing about all of these thinkers is that in different ways, they looked to science for a kind of exit from the world that science had revealed, because the world that science had revealed through Darwin's theory was a world in which humans appeared as accidents, and they would eventually disappear as a species, and in the meantime, when each of them died, that was the end of the story for each of them. And for practically everyone, including in some moods, even Darwin himself, that was an intolerable vision, because for one thing, it meant there was no progress, and it also meant that the universe was indifferent to human meaning or empty of human meaning.
But Philip, your story goes back a lot further, doesn't it? And I'm looking at the cover of your book now, and it's got a sort of medieval picture of a with somebody sort of blowing bellows underneath a tube with a baby in it.
This is an engraving from that accompanied one edition of Goethe's Faust. Of course, that wasn't medieval, but it was drawing on the medieval idea of the homunculus, the a small creature, a human-like creature that could be created by alchemical means. And this is something that happens within Goethe's Faust. And it was certainly an idea that was talked about in the Middle Ages. It's one of our earliest ideas for how humans might be created, that it might be done alchemically. And I mean, one amongst the things that are interesting about this image is that it's basically in vitro creation of life.
Yeah, that's what immediately struck me.
It's Aldous Huxley right there. It's his babies in bottles, and it's just being done by alchemy rather than by biotechnology.
So there's a lot of sort of really nice anecdotal, picturesque stuff in these books, but they also have a polemical edge, and yours particularly, John. I wonder if you'd just read a little bit from your introduction, which sets the terms of your argument.
In what might seem a paradox, scientific empiricism, that's to say, reliance on actual experience rather than supposedly rational principles, has very often gone with an interest in magic. Science and the occult have interacted at many points. They came together in two revolts against death, each claiming that science could give humanity what religion and magic had promised, immortal life.
Alok and Philip, you're the scientists. What do you make of that? Alok?
Science is the ultimate codification of rationalism, curiosity, whatever you like to call it, and I suppose when you are curious about the world and you see the edges, you want to examine those, a scientist would want to examine those edges and find ways of maybe thwarting them, if depending on your motivation, or just understanding how those things might help to make people have better lives. So the ideas that I was writing about are simply an observation that thanks to evidence-based medicine, better drugs, an understanding of how the human physiology works, in the past half century, it's not even more than that really, our lifespans have been increasing. I mean, this is not about making yourself live, become immortal, but simply every minute that this podcast goes out, our lifespan increases by 12 seconds because of what science has done in terms of understanding the body. In that sense, it's just the march of progress, I guess.
But you also have stuff about, you know, about experiments that have been done with rats and with yeast. I was very interested in that.
So there are experiments on rats and yeast that have expanded their lifespan.
By huge amounts.
Well, for them.
In the case of yeast.
For rats and yeast, yes. So a yeast might just live a day or less, but you can expand its life to six times that if you tinker with a couple of genes. Now,
Tell us what those genes are. I found this really interesting.
The other experiment that has been done, that's been shown that rats, for example, can have expanded lifetimes if you starve them. And basically the idea is there that if you have a calorie restricted diet, then certain genes inside you switch on into hibernation mode, switch off all your unnecessary functions, and end up living longer. You might not be able to reproduce, but you will end up living longer. Now, no one quite knows why that happens, but yes, nutrition is involved in that, and translating this stuff into humans is fiercely complicated.
The other one, if I can just interpolate the other one, which is seemed to be is cutting off reproduction, redirecting the energy that goes into reproduction into sustaining the existing life.
Well, reproduction is the point of any life form, and evolutionarily, that's the whole point. You're meant to grow up, reproduce, and then then ideally die off quickly, so you don't use up the ecosystem resources that your children should be using up. Reproduction is incredibly energy intensive. It takes a lot of energy to produce the gametes, and if you're a human being or a mammal of some sort, and the actual process takes a lot. So if you can shut all those systems down, the unnecessary systems, you can live longer.
What's the point of life then, Philip, if you've done that?
No, you just asked me a very big question there, which I might have to sidestep. I mean, what intrigues me about all of this is the idea that we now seem to be wanting to talk about death in genetic terms. You know, Alok has quite rightly said, you know, there isn't going to be a death gene, or even, I don't think, a suite of genes. Genes are involved in various processes, some of which will be connected with death. So, you know, cell maintenance and DNA repair and so on. But it would be wrong to start thinking about this in terms of somehow death having a genetic basis. And if we can find the right genes and, you know, tweak them in some way, then death will be cheated, because, you know, death is a property of the system. Genes do not control you to that degree.
Yeah, I mean, Alok talks about free radicals and things, which we all know about as well, and alcohol.
But what it is, it's more like a collection of errors that just mean that your body just can't deal with all the errors, and you become older and more tired, and things just fall apart, rather than at one point something says, right, now it's time to go.
Well, I think, I mean, death is, and I say in my book, death, you know, it's not even a scientific term. I mean, you know, clearly the organism can die, but in some sense, the death of the organism is not to be equated with all the cells shutting down. Something carries on for a while.
One thing which is sort of, this conversation has stirred in me is the fact, which I think is a very interesting fact, that reproduction practically never figures in ideas of the afterlife. And that, I think, goes all the way back to the original myths of resurrection and immortality. In Christianity, I mean, we tend to think of Christianity as a religion which says the body dies but the soul goes on. But that's not how it started. In the early Jewish cult, the idea is that there was something like a breath, something that entered into human beings. But immortality meant being brought back from the dead by God at the end of time as the physical organism one had earlier on been. There's no talk of reproduction there either. So those people who have been brought back from the dust, from the dead, will be there forever.
That ties in really interestingly with your title, doesn't it? I mean, it's unnatural.
What I mean by unnatural, one of the points I want to make in the book is that when we call something unnatural, we're not just talking about its feasibility, and we're not even just making a categorization of things that are natural and things that are unnatural. We're making a moral judgment about it. The word unnatural is meant to instill in us something more than just something that doesn't happen in nature. It's something we're supposed to condemn. something we're supposed to disapprove of. One of the things that interests me about cloning is that that has been portrayed in some circumstances as a kind of immortality, that there seems to be a belief that somehow that perpetuates the self, that, you know, somehow you're not producing a new person that way. And I suspect that cloning of human beings will be possible within a few decades, if not sooner. When that happens, I think it intersects with the mythical idea of the transmigration of souls, that somehow there's a continuity of consciousness or a continuity of being, and that you're having some sort of immortality within your clones.
But there are two issues involved with living forever, aren't there? There's living longer within a lifespan, and there's the sort of the yeast that you can make live six times as long. So there's living 100 to 120, all of us, instead of to 80, and there's living to 1,000. Are they both possible, do you think, or are we really only talking about maximising our potential?
There's nothing technically wrong at the moment in someone living to 100, 120 very easily. I mean, right now, someone this year will be born that will live to 120.
How do we know that?
We know that technology for medicine, epidemiology, all these things will get better. Life, looking after yourself will get better.
Whatever the kind of technologies of calorific restriction or cryonic suspension or cyberspace uploading are adopted to keep us going for very, very long periods, they'll all be rooted in a physical world in which the human animal lives as it's done before. And therefore, they'll all be potentially, and I would say actually, disrupted by political and social upheavals. So even if some people, let's say 100 years from now, can expect to live 200 or 300 years, they'll be living in a world probably in which other people still only live 50 or 60 years. And they'll be living in a world which even they will have no certainty of living their lifespan to that full in any individual case, because there'll still be probably great upheavals of various kinds which go with history.
Now, I want to just turn this over to our commenters, because people may remember that a couple of weeks ago, John wrote a piece for Guardian Review, and we've had very lively correspondence on the comment thread. Havatai says, "I wonder what John Gray would make of this statement by Hegel. Death has a double meaning. A, it is precisely the immediate passing away of the natural. B, it is the death of the purely natural and therefore the birth of something higher, namely the spiritual. It is the very concept of death which separates us from the animals and makes us human, and that in itself represents an impassable barrier between human minds and those of other animals."
As far as we can find out, humans are alone, not perhaps in having an experience of death, but in having a knowledge of a more fully developed conception that they're going to cease to exist.
A sense of their mortality.
A sense of the mortality. It doesn't seem to be. It seems that some animals respond to death in others. But their lives aren't, so to speak, constantly informed or infused by a sense of their own mortality, as human lives evidently are, because we can find that from poetry and mythology and graveyards and religions. And so one of the things I say in the book is that the search for immortality through science and technology shows that humans remain the death-defined animal. Humans are different from other animals in this respect, which is that the knowledge of their own mortality creates a kind of permanent conundrum for them in their lives.
A conundrum, but I think also an inspiration.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I think that's one of the things that I fear about a future in which we're immortal. You know, we don't actually know how we'll respond to that, but I think it's fairly, I think one can make a case that the sense of our mortality has been tremendously inspirational to us, even to the extent of inspiring us to create ideas about trying to make ourselves immortal. You know, however fruitless that might be, it's an aspect of what the sense of mortality does for us.
John Gray, Philip Ball and Alok Jha there. Now we're going to turn our fire on the critics. You might feel that lines Robert and me up as predominantly print journalists against Katie and Richard, whose main domain is the internet. But are you right? Richard, can you just begin by explaining what prompted this discussion?
Well, it all comes from a piece in last Sunday's Observer New Review, where the American writer Neil Gabler wrote about the end of cultural elitism. He was, I think, specifically focusing rather more on film, but he argued that people don't need conventional critics anymore because they've already got their own social networks. One of the examples he cites is Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, which is, he says has been much less successful with the American public than it was with the critical establishment, where, of course, it got rave reviews and hype to the max.
Mm-hmm. Just to pick up your point about his frame of reference, he also talked about food critics. We're not interested in food. We certainly don't watch films on this podcast. We're far too busy reading books. But as you can expect, this caused quite a bit of a stir on the web pages. One commenter, John Smealy, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, wrote, "Mel Brooks was right. Critics, who needs them? They just sit there rubbing their legs together." And we've also got a couple more people who rang in with their comments.
Personally, I think critics are less relevant. I've bought sort of over 20-odd books last year, and none of them involved reading a review at all. I'd prefer just to read an excerpt of the book or check out comments on Amazon or wherever I might be buying it from.
Hello, this is Sam Jordison. I'm a critic, and you listeners better start listening. You need us critics. You might not know it, but you damn well do. Indeed, I can think of few people who enrich your otherwise meaningless lives quite so very much. Even if you don't read a word we write, the fact that we're here on our ivory tower gives you a chance to access the sublime that you would otherwise, quite rightly, be entirely denied. In fact, I'd say that Web 3.0 has opened up new avenues for critics. The good critic can now become the instigator and facilitator of discussion as much as an arbiter of taste, and that new engagement is worthwhile, not to mention highly enjoyable. We're all here because we value talking about books, after all.
Go, Sam Jordison. Gosh, I didn't expect that. I would just want to start with raising one issue that a couple of the commenters on the website raised, Robert, and that is the difference between American and UK critics.
Yes.
Different traditions.
In America, the spectrum of criticism comes from a much wider range. Here, it's much more based in London and the triangle of London, Oxford and Cambridge, and is much more, I mean, to use a pejorative term, elitist. The critics are more highly trained as writers.
But this is totally different to theatre criticism, for example. My own background was in theatre criticism. And, you know, you have the Frank Rich, the Butcher of Broadway, who could kill something stone dead, one person. But you're saying literary criticism in the States is broader.
It's broader and it's generally more benign.
OK, well, let's move on quickly to the second issue raised in the comment threads, which is the difficult question of literary criticism versus reviewing. Perhaps, Katie, you'd like to come in on this.
Well, I think there's a huge difference between really deep, incisive literary criticism and a review who, as Gabler said in his article, is intended to shift copies or sell tickets or whatever it is. And what he said was that the critics got Franzen wrong because the book didn't sell as well, and that they'd missed some cultural milestone, I think was how he put it. And I think real criticism, you won't know if it was a cultural milestone for some time afterwards.
Now, J.Y.T. Carruthers on the website said the word critic comes from the Greek meaning to sift, not from the Greek meaning to preen, boost, legislate, or accept freebies from publishers. Ooh.
Yeah, the job of the critic is certainly to come to sort of some sort of opinion as to whether something is any good or not. And whether that's a different job to literary critic or not, I don't know.
No, but as Kate pointed out, reviewing is a turn. When you're invited to do a review, which is a real skill, you're invited to do a turn of 1,000 words or 500 words, 750 words, and to present an opinion which will be entertaining or provocative for the reader on a Sunday or a Saturday or whenever it is.
So this is different to literary criticism.
It's quite different. It's quite different. I mean, obviously, it bears some of the characteristics of literary criticism, but it is designed to be journalistic, and it's a different kind of skill. And I find when I was literary editor of The Observer that people who were writers who were literary critics, academics and so forth, took a while to adjust to the new modalities of writing for a Sunday paper.
Now, Tereus on our website said, a good critic helps you better understand the work he, she is reviewing. Tereus references Frank Kermode, Jenny Diski, John Carey, none of whom actually often write for us. In fact, Frank Kermode doesn't write for very many people these days. And they say, Tereus says, these people can write reviews that seriously deepen your understanding of the book in question. Katie, in your blog, do you aim to educate people? Do you think that's a thing that blogs don't do either, as well as perhaps newspaper journalism?
I have a very conversational, light, jocular style because I do. It is entertainment and to be read and enjoyed. And largely, with the books I cover are poetry. One of my kind of aims is to make it attractive to people who think they don't like poetry. They like reading the blog. I might just lead somebody to read a book of poetry. So it's very much about educating and entertaining at the same time, and also just keeping people or making them alive to what's going on in the world, really.
I think that's extremely attractive, I must say. And I think that, you know, the great reviewers, I mean, Kommode is a good example, and George Steiner, who used to write for The Observer, is a good example. I mean, great scholars and academics, but they were also tremendously entertaining and would deepen your understanding at the same time. There's no reason why you can't be entertaining and also be very profound as well.
Yeah, but a couple of people have weighed in with other views. Richard, can you read us what White Paint said?
White Paint said in the comments, "I remember the critic Margarita Lasky many years ago solemnly informing us that she would have placed Dickens only in the second rank of great writers, a marvellous combination of condescension, snobbery and irrelevance to anything that mattered."
Well, what Margarita Lasky was doing was precisely what Katie's doing on her blog, which is to entertain the reader. She used to put on an act, essentially.
But the double job has always been that at the same time you're aspiring, you're hoping,
yes,
to give some sort of useful or interesting judgment about the book in question.
To go back 300 years or 200 years, Samuel Johnson was a tremendous entertainer and also a great critic in his time, and he would understand this conversation completely.
Mm. OK, well, I'm going to now move us on to another issue which is raised by all these comments, which is what gives a critic a right to have opinions and to voice those opinions in a public space?
I think the number one qualification is actually knowing what you're talking about.
So what is your qualification for talking about books?
Well, I think it's just because I've been reading books very deeply my whole entire life, you know, since I was before I could read, really, through my parents. And, well, they were both English teachers, and then I studied English literature. And, you know, they have been the water in which I've swum my whole life.
How many people read
I don't think I'm infallible. I mean, the most I've ever had was about 18,000 in a month. At the moment, it seems to be slightly lower than that.
So that is a huge readership you have, and they obviously
at times huge.
So they come back to you because they believe in what you say.
Yeah, or they find it entertaining or informative. You know, I know a lot of people in the poetry world read it, and they. I mean, Roddy Lumsden called it the guardian of book blogs, which I was very pleased with and put
on
my sidebar.
We like that. but that's quite different, isn't it? We come back to literary criticism, where people have sort of PhDs and chairs and this, that and the other.
But I wonder if it's actually rather similar, in the sense that the reason why people go to read Baroque in Hackney is because it's entertaining, because they want to read it. And the reason why they go to read a newspaper is because it's entertaining, because they want to read it. And the same is true of even academic literary criticism. Papers are famous, papers get cited, their authors get professorships and get to hold prestigious positions on panels and so on because their works are useful, because people want to read them. And of course, being accurate and knowing something, knowing about the field is part of that, but it's not all.
Mm. Robert, there's another thing that comes out of this, which is that sometimes you read critics to disagree with them, don't you, as well as to agree with them.
Part of what's going on here, I think, is the academic literary critical establishment has become often very hard to follow and quite arcane, and these blogs have sprung up. And some of these pages have sprung up precisely to provide a more enjoyable account of what's going on. You know, books are interesting. I mean, people want to hear about them in a kind of intelligible and entertaining and approachable, accessible way, which the academics often don't supply. And part of the trouble has been that the rarefication of the academic establishment and its retreat into obscurantism, jargon, and very, very tedious, you know, academic disputes.
Now, I have a comment here from Belobo, who says, "I like it that periodicals employ regular critics. Once you've determined that their opinions chime more or less with yours, you come to trust their judgment. Going out into the blogosphere means you have to make a dedicated search for a review rather than just being able to read it in passing." What do you say about that, Katie?
You search out things that you're interested in, whether they're in newspapers. You have your regular newspaper, you have your regular blogs that you read.
Doesn't that narrow the culture down to a sort of fan culture rather than a sort of general reading culture?
It has been said that because people go to the things that they know they're going to like on the blogosphere, that it could create a situation where there's less debate because people are only reading people they agree with, you know.
Also, my experience of blogs is they're lively and they start all kinds of discussion and they go in all kinds of directions. They can't be controlled and they're very freewheeling.
Yeah.
So I think on the whole they're a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's also important, you know, people talk about blogs versus traditional reviews and criticism. And really the main thing I always think about this, I think it's very important to make the distinctions. First, as we've said, that reviews and in-depth criticism are two different things. And I do write more in-depth essays in other places. But the other thing is that there are many different kinds of blogs, you know, and you can look for the kind of blog that you're interested in. Some of them are very serious. Some of them really exist just to do short reviews.
it's a very old thing called word of mouth. And word of mouth has been empowered by the internet and by the blogs and mass culture has suddenly made word of mouth much more interesting. And it's a very interesting phenomenon, which has just taken on a new dimension. But it's essentially the same old thing.
Thanks to everyone who took part in this discussion, either remotely or in the studio. I'd like to end by quoting Roger Scruton, perhaps not a natural Guardian man, but brought to our attention by a Guardian reader, Kim Hong Do. It goes like this. Only if we teach the young to criticise do we really offer them culture. Otherwise, what we call culture is a collective mental indolence.
They say I might as well face the truth, but I am just too long in the tooth. So I'm an OAP and weak mean, but I've not yet quite gone to see. I may be over the hill now that I have retired, fading away, but I'm not yet expired. Clapped out, run down, too old to save, one foot in the grave.
Yes, that's how quite a lot of us feel already, even before we've reached the age of reason. But it's a particular interest of Paul Bailey, who has just selected for our book site his top 10 stories of old age. It coincides with his own latest novel, Chapman's Odyssey.
Hello and goodbye, said a grinning Christopher. I'm here to make sure you've gone. Very kind of you. As thoughtful as ever. It was the least I could do. Then it was Wilfrid Granger's turn to pay his last respects. I wish I had your luck, Harry. I may look healthy, but I'm really very ill. First of all, my heart. Second, my diabetes. Third, my prostate. Fourth, my ingrowing toenail. And you never had to endure cataracts, did you? I'm so sorry for you, Wolf. I wish other people were. It's a cruel, uncaring world we live in. Oh, the indignity of getting old. An exasperated Alice Chapman had no sympathy for the whining individual who was saying goodbye to her son. Push off, misery guts! What kind of man are you? Moan, moan, moan. Is that what Harry wants to hear at a time like this? No, it bloody well isn't. Actually, it bloody well was what he wanted to hear, because Wilf's limitless self-concern and self-pity amused Harry Chapman. He couldn't explain to his mother, who was no longer there anyhow, why this was so. She had always found his sense of humour peculiar.
His story tracks the psychic voyage of an elderly writer trapped in his hospital bed. Lindsay Irving pointed out that his first book, 40 years ago, was also about old age.
Well, I'm an old man now, so there is a slight difference. I was 28 when I wrote out The Jerusalem, and people thought it odd at the time that somebody so young should be writing about old age. But I was brought up around old people because my father sired me when he was seriously getting on in life. And my mother had me when she was 41, which in 1937 was quite a kind of miraculous event because nobody did that sort of thing then. And when my father died, when I was about 11, I was brought up for quite a while by an elderly couple who lived to be almost, both of them lived to be almost 100. And so I never thought of old age as you see on advertisements, you know, people bent over, you know, people looking absolutely in extremis. Now, I know that a lot of people go into extremis, but the thing I felt then, and I still feel, is that if you've got your wits about you, if you're still intelligent, if you're still curious about the world, you know, there is life in you. And my mother was kept alive by her sarcasm because she lived to be 90, because she never had a good word to say about anybody, but it gave her an incredible energy.
But, I mean, there's certain, which what characterises this novel is that memories loom almost as large as your present experience. In fact, larger, rather.
Yes, that's very true. And the thing is, as you get older, you remember way, way back. You remember your earliest years. I did have a serious heart problem some years ago, and I'm on dozens of pills. So I'm intent on living life to the full. And I actually enjoyed writing a lot of this novel, even though the man was in this terrible state. And the idea of it came to me because a very great friend of mine, his mother was in hospital in Oxford, and she went in with a stomach complaint, and they couldn't find out what was wrong with her. But she was in fairly serious pain, so they were giving her morphine, which meant that she wandered and she was talking to people that, you know, none of us understood who she was talking to and all that sort of thing. And she never came out of that hospital. I actually wanted him to go on living at the end of this book. But I took the advice of two very good friends and who said he has to die. So the funeral came as a kind of afterthought.
Yes, because there are two endings. One is his sort of imaginary recovery, and the other is a postscript with the funeral that actually happened. And it is very much a novel about his Chapman's Odyssey. It's about the imaginative journeys he makes from his bed, is it not?
Thank God you've picked that up, because somebody has already said, how can you call it an odyssey if he's stuck in a bed all the time? Well, you know, that is just absolutely crass. And the thing is, I wanted to write a book about a writer. I don't usually like books about writers writing and all that sort of thing, but I thought if he's going into hospital and he is a writer and he's lived among books all his life, then some of the people who would be visiting him would be the people that he's lived with in books, because he's the kind of reader and writer who lives with his characters. And, you know, once you've met a character in Dickens or a character in Dostoevsky, and they make a huge effect on you, they're your friends for life in a kind of strange way.
Yes, and all that he's visited by the people who have loomed largest in his emotional life, and some of them are fictional, and some of them are that, you know, his lurid mother.
Fred Astaire comes into it. I mean, I've always been a mad fan of Fred Astaire. I just couldn't resist having him dance with Queen Celeste, the wife of King Baba the Elephant.
Harry himself, the basic structure of his life is very similar to your own in terms of the fact that he is a novelist, he's a former actor, gay man, and so on. This is obviously a work of imagination, and I wonder how, as a writer, you sort of negotiate and find the balance between genuine experience and the work of the imagination.
I've used my own childhood in Battersea, in a working-class family. I've used it. My father was in the First World War.
And that becomes a sort of familiar practice over the years as a novelist of just sort of working with sculpting or moulding real-life incidents with your imagination.
That's right. And my friend Beryl Bainbridge, all her early novels are all about her Liverpool family. And the only difference was that she usually added a murder to brighten things up a bit. But there were no murders in her family. I haven't gone to that extreme, but I had an aunt whose real name was Mabel, but she is the basis of Aunt Rose. Now, my Aunt Mabel saw good in everybody. She saw good in people who didn't even know they were good. You know, she was one of those people. Mm. And I think people like that keep the world going, actually. Yes. I believe in goodness. I believe that it exists. You don't have to be intelligent to have it. You don't have to have an intellectual background. It's just natural to some people. And it was completely natural to her. She was the kindest person I've ever met in my life. So I wanted to celebrate her, and I thought Rose was the right name for somebody like that.
Yes, but as with his cruel and malicious, Rose calls her Malice rather than Alice, mother, you have also very often written about cruel and spiky characters and the experience of loving characters who are very hard to love.
It's one of the tests of life, really, isn't it? And then you apply the same criticism to yourself. You think, well, there must be something in me that people have to take trouble with. You know, I think it's true of most human relationships. I think some people are going to be worried by the jokiness of this book, but I couldn't envisage it in any other way. You know, I do have a dark sense of humour, and I think that I've been in and out of hospital several times in recent years, and it's my curiosity that's kept me going. You know, the last time I was in for a very minor complaint, a sort of tiny a matter of something on my foot. And because of the shortage of beds, I was put into a ward opposite somebody who was clearly dying. And you have to be cheerful in those circumstances, you know. Some people can't take it.
Hospital does make some people sick, does it not? Yes. And another notable thing about this novel is that it's full of poetry. Harry entertains his nurses by reciting poetry from memory.
No, I was brought up in that educational system where the teachers used to say, if you like a poem, learn it by heart. It's the way to appreciate it. So now I find that a lot of them come back to me. I thought it would be a nice twist rather than somebody singing. I've been in a hospital ward where somebody insisted on singing to the nurses till it drove them up the wall because he couldn't sing at all. Bit like Wagner on The X Factor, you know.
And what would be shocking for readers of this novel and readers who know the rest of your work, which has won various awards, including the Somerset Maugham over the year, was that you had considerable trouble finding a publisher for it.
It was very strange. I mean, it went to my publisher, the one people who'd published my previous book. They sat on it for 3 months. Another publisher sat on it for 6 months. And one publisher still had it a year and 10 days after it had been submitted to him. He wanted to publish it. But the salespeople resisted it because all they saw was that it was about old age and dying. They don't read books, you see. The marketing people make the decisions. If they see death, no, it's a no-no. And the point about this book is that death isn't a kind of, in the end of this book, it isn't a fearsome thing at all. It's something that he almost has come completely to terms with, as I've found a lot of people have. You know, it's a fact of life.
Paul Bailey there, and it's certainly good to know how determinedly upbeat he is. It could be a help to some of the people we're meeting next week. Sarah Crown of this parish will be meeting Sarah Manguzzo, one of the New York Times writers to watch, who has written a remarkable memoir of living with a rare and serious disease. We'll broaden that out into a discussion of how illness and creativity interact and how writing can help to get through those challenging times. We'd love you to tell us about the books that have made you feel better, or of course not. Look out for our interactive thread on guardian.co.uk/books. Also, do leave your comments about this week's discussion on our podcast page. And can we persuade you to subscribe on a regular basis, please, either through our podcast page or through iTunes? Now, Richard, a quick word about what's coming up in the meantime.
Yes, on Saturday, Guardian Review has a big piece from Harry Kunzru on science fiction and how he first fell in love with it. We also review Philip Bull's Unnatural, which you've heard about already in this podcast. In Sunday's Observer New Review, Rachel Cook interviews Edna O'Brien, still glamorous in her 80s.
And we've got quite a lot going on the website over the weekend, haven't we, Richard?
Yes, we're concentrating on libraries. Tomorrow sees a day of protests against threatened closures in libraries across the country. And we've got a map on the website which will allow you to find your nearest participating branch. And you can follow the protests on our live blog, which will be on the site through the day tomorrow.
Well, it's going to be a busy weekend for us. But that's all from this week's podcast. From me, Sarah, Katie, Robert, and our producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.